members. Can I do that now, please? Members, we'll see by show of hands.
Mr. Madamatia, Ms. Mutahum.
Yes.
Prince Bunce Namashe.
Yes.
Mr. Twing.
Any other hands?
Those are the hands currently that we currently have, Chair.
Okay. So let us proceed with those hands at the moment, starting with Honorable Malamacha.
No, thank you, Chair. Allow me to express my sincere acknowledgement of the two reports, of which both were very clear and were not just reports, were also showing what was intended and what has happened and what is the mitigation on that. Starting with the first presentation, Chairperson, one was very much worried the manner in which the NLC is not making it, and in many cases by not complying, especially with the PSMA. But one is also happy with the consequences management that has been recommended. So it will be up to us to ensure that the entities, they comply, so that at the end of the day, the good work that has been seen through by other entities doing good after we have been so hard at work to ensure that they do right. It too, and SAPS also do the same. I'm saying this because if you go to the issue of SAPS, can't be correct that we have an entity that does not have a permanent CEO. It means somebody is not taking care of the day-to-day work. It can't be correct that we've got an entity which does not have a full-time board. It means people are doing as they wish. These are the things that I've noticed. And by the recommendation, are very clear that it must be given a sense of agency to deal with that. The second presentation, Chairperson, very informative, detailed, and with the overall percentage of 98.3 achievements, that also matches the output. One is very satisfied, and one has this to say that if all the department can up their game and do as this department has done, I think the lost confidence of the South Africans to many departments can easily be gained. I think the department has done well and they made us proud. They must just keep it up. Where there are some findings, I think that must be the target for a few months, because the very same findings are not that much and there are reasons behind. So we just need to follow those reasons and ensure that those reasons are easily followed. However, after said that, there is these few questions that one will want, especially on slide 6, on the investment pledge. There were pledges made of 1.1 trillion since the start of the investment conference. There is further indication that a significant implementation of commitment has been made. How many have materialized and in what sectors? And how many jobs have they created? I think that one can be clarified too. The other one will be, to what extent has the steel master plan supported new entrants into the industry, and how has the master plan ensured the viability of the SMEs? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Mulamecha. Honourable Motaung.
Thanks, Chair, for the opportunity. Let me welcome all the presentations for today. I have only two questions, Minister. One, on slide 44, to what extent are legal imports from China undermining our efforts of reindustrialization? And how is it impacting local industries, and has been done practically outside of discussions held with the Chinese embassy? Lastly, the department has limited authorities on industrial parks, which are mainly the preserve of provincial governments. What is the department doing to improve their efficiency and growth, as they are critical in creating jobs and driving our industrial competitiveness? Thanks, Chef.
Thank you, Honorable Burns. Now, Mamashe.
Yeah, thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I just want to, I take it that the AG is still around, Honorable Chair. Am I correct?
They are on the platform. Yes, I see them.
Okay. Well, Chair, in welcoming their report as well as that of the department, maybe if I can start with the AG. Having identified such a glaring audit irregularities, especially at the NLC, is there a system through which they can readily identify some of these challenges within real time? You know, because sometimes, you know, this thing of identifying challenges after the fact is really becoming a problem. I just want to check if there could be a system which could mitigate, you know, and or circumvent some of these weaknesses in such a way that instead of finding ourselves deep into wasteful and or irregular expenditure, there's a way to avoid that. And then in respect of the department, Chair, the pandemic, which is COVID, as well as the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, you know, have actually demonstrated the extent to which South Africa should build internal resilience and self-sufficiency, so as to reduce dependence on imports. You know, one of the ways to achieve this, of course, through localization and beneficiation. So the question that I would have, what direct benefits have the South African economy derived from its localization policy? Of course, this could also be looked at in terms of what is the impact of the structural adjustment program, as well as the sovereign debt and conditionalities posed by such institutional arrangements in respect of this international monetary organization, be it IMF or World Bank, in ways that contribute to the deregulation. Thank you very much.
you very much, Honorable String.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, also just appreciation for the presentations from the AG as well as from the department. First question, Minister, how do you plan to implement the Auditor General recommendations on reducing or reviewing the external legal services, the use of external legal services, where 31% of goods and services spending at the National Lotteries Commission relates to legal fees? So this question is particularly relevant, noting there is an internal legal unit of some 8 employees with a wage bill of 8.9 million rand per annum. And the second is, what, if any, are the timelines for appointing, as recommended by the Auditor General, for appointing at SABS a permanent CEO and a fully functional board to lead and govern the entity? And then I think just my last question or comment, while we appreciate the pledges of hundreds of millions of rands for the various projects and industrial development in South Africa, which is an attempt to drive industrialization and hence also increase employment. But these particular pledges, projects are clearly insufficient to turn around and to make any dent to our huge unemployment burden, which is set to exceed some 40% according to some predictions. And so when viewed against our current unemployment rate, where the department's policies are actually failing to cause the unemployment rate and hence poverty and inequality to decrease, what then are the plans to look at rather than capital intensive initiatives, labor intensive initiatives to reduce unemployment? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Thring. Honorable Moatse.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me also join other members for welcoming the presentation of the AG and the department. I've got only 2 questions. First question is for department. Just want to know, how has the Steel Master Plan support downstream industries, and what opportunities have been created? Then lastly, Minister, noting that government is the biggest procurer of goods and services, to what extent is the government supporting the procurement of local produced vehicle to ensure the sustainability of the automotive industry support vehicle support and viable? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Moatse. Honorable Mbuyani.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, for the opportunity. Chair, also welcoming the report, both reports, AGs and Minister's report. As we look at this report, we need to look at the impact made by this achievement from the department. What is it that they had in terms of the job creation? And also we must check as to why does it seem that they're unable to drive up our mandate as a manufacturing capacity and create jobs as well. There's also one clarity that I need to understand, man. Can we be clarified by the role of the trade lead? There's a name called trade lead. and their operation in terms of transformational agenda industrialization. The minister spoke of the who is who versus transformational and industrialization program in terms of the competition commission. And also, I think in terms of that, I just want to check, because the increase in concentration of our economy poses a serious threat towards the sustenance of SMEs, which undermine inclusive economic growth and the potential of creation of jobs. And I just wanted to check also, what is the commission playing? Maybe the role in preventing this from happening. And further, what collaborative efforts have been the commission undertaken with the relevant stakeholders to ensure that SME are not locked out of participation in the main in the inclusive economy? Maybe the department, there's proactive measures that are being adopted by the commission to ensure that markets do get overly concentrated, maybe. Noting that there's a high degree of inequality in distribution of firm income, with a share of turnover of largest 10% of firm was on average of 85.8% turnover in South Africa, with the bottom 50% of firms, which are all SME, receiving a shares of 1.6% of total economic turnover. This is very concerning, means we are struggling to transform our economy. Perhaps explain the reason why our economy is unable to create jobs as an SME. Can I therefore get a clarity, what is the role of the commission playing in transforming this? And that also the stakeholders are part of this all process. There's one disturbing issue, Chair, in terms of the concentration of transformation. In the real estate and the services sector, the three largest made of 59 or 60% of assets under management of 13 listed firms. The sector is also highly concentrated, notwithstanding in the fact that all real estate firms are listed, and this may not be correct reflection of the reality. However, the commission considered conducting a market inquiry into real estate sector in terms of the section 43B1 of the Competition Act to consider whether there is any distortion or restriction of competition in this sector of the real estate sector. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Biani. Honourable McPherson.
Thanks so much. Just sort of a overarching question for the Minister. If things are as well-functioning and well-put by the Department today, what is the Minister's view in that not translating into economic growth and job creation? So where is the missing link into how well the department presents its performance and what that actually translates into economic reality? And maybe if he could just give us what his view might be for what is missing, or why it is not translating into economic growth and job creation. I'd also just like to know where the Auto Green Paper adoption in terms of cabinet and progression on that fits into the presentation today, and whether that is linked to a performance outcome, because that is outstanding for more than a year. And then I'd also like to know where trade agreements fit into performance indicators, particularly the review on AGOA and the EPA, because those are coming up pretty quickly. And how does the department measure its performance in securing renewal of those agreements? And then lastly, with respect to the investment drive, the numbers we're told, what percentage of the 1.1 trillion is actually brownfields investment? So brand new, completely new, never been in South Africa before, versus investment in existing projects and investments that were scheduled by businesses to take place already. So that's the first one and 1.1 leg of the question. And the second is, do you think it's right to measure government entities expanding their investment, which is essentially taxpayers' money being used to create the impression that there's investment in those? So like Transnet, as an example, and some of the others that are often cited as investment. So those would just be my questions.
Thank you very much, Honourable McPherson. There being no further hands, I would just like to add that as the portfolio committee, I think we will keep a special eye and work out a roadmap for the NLC in terms of our oversight role, because it is concerning what we see there, what we hear from the AG and from the annual report. And then I think for me, is there any way we can strengthen our executive authority, or any way we can strengthen our hand in the way industrial parks are managed? Because we know that many of them are not functioning optimally, because we saw the report, the overall report on in the annual report on industrial parks, but obviously we don't see it again, what was there before. Because, for instance, when we did oversight at Ekandastria, we first of all found out that the industrial park falls under Mpumalanga, but they pay services to Tshwane, and that there was quite a high vacancy rate and vandalism of existing infrastructure. So I think, you know, it would be good to hear what the department's plan is in that regard. But let me hand over first to the Office of the AG, and then to the minister and his team. Mr. Shabangu or Mr. Posa, I'm not sure if Mr. Posa is back.
I'm back, Chair, and thank you very much. I will respond to the question from Ben Singonashe. I think that was the only question that was directed to us from the question that the honorable members asked. And the question was on the irregularities that in fact NLC, and if there are ways or systems that we can perhaps help identify these challenges within real time, and because of the after effects of the audit, identifying them might be a little bit too late. So I think the response to the question is, firstly, by the nature of our work of our regulatory audit, it's always going to be an after effect, because we will be auditing reports that have to be prepared in terms of the financial statements, and also for the performance report. Those that have to be prepared by the management, then we will come after to then report in line with the PFMA. But I think, as we have seen with a COVID-19 and now most recently the post-unrest, there is an opportunity to perform real-time audit where and necessary. The office is open to that. Either through, due to the nature of or the of the scenarios of the issues like the COVID-19 funds and the post on those funds, the work that the office approved to be done is really done. But also in line with our professional standards as auditors, we do allow or we are open to having those kind of arrangements with management or with those sorts of governance to say if there's an instance where there's a need to do an audit in time before the actual audit, maybe it is something that is agreed upon and looking at the resources that we have and the time, like times and the personnel to perform the audit. Our office is always open to investments, and then we can have those real-time audits to ensure that the controls that are there, we review the controls and ensure the controls are preventative in nature to ensure that the fruitless and the irregularities do not happen or were detected before the amount are spent. So I think that's the response to the question. I'm not sure if I fully responded to the question from the honorable member. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, thank you very much. I think you have, Mr. Poster, thank you. Minister?
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you to the members for the questions and the comments. And I appreciate the positive comments that have been made. There's about 15 or so questions, just over 15 questions. So I'm going to try to see where I can combine some of them and run through it and see if the DG would like to add then or any of the team members. Starting with the issue around the investment pledges that's come up from Honorable Malamecha as well as Honorable McPherson. The pledges that have been received to date is 1.1 trillion rand. And as we were preparing for the investment, the last investment conference, some 330 billion of that had already flowed, meaning that either it's in projects that are completed. An example of a completed project would be Mercedes-Benz that I referred to, where they made a commitment in 2018. It took them a couple of years then to get the implementation going because it means reorganizing the shop floor, getting new machinery in, changing the model to the new model, and then implementing it. Some of them are where you've got a large mining development where over a couple of years you are digging that mine, you're building the structures to support it, you get the machinery in there to move the ore up and so on. And so in a case like that, you may not have completed the full project within the available time or to date, but that would then be rolled out. That's why each of the pledges are typically over a five-year period. Some are realized, of course, sooner, but generally companies from the moment when they take a decision that they're going to invest, they do it that way. Now, some of these sub questions that have come up is how do we distinguish between what was already planned and what is not planned, brownfields versus greenfield, and public entity versus private entity. If I can take those as a group of related questions. First, on the investment, from our drive to get investment going, we're trying to expand the overall output of the South African economy, and with that, the number of jobs and economic opportunities. Now, there is no artificial distinction between a brownfield and a greenfield. Let me use an example. If we have an existing plant that produces 100,000 pens per month, and it recapitalizes its business, it gets new technology, it upgrades the skill, the management, and it's able to increase its output to 200,000 pence per month. That is a real increase in the productive capacity of South Africa with all the other benefits that come with it that I'll talk about in a moment. If instead of that, there was a new factory set up that also produces, let's say, 100,000 pence or even 50,000 pence, there is no a priori sense of why greenfields is better than brownfields. So what we're looking at is trying to strengthen the investment commitments by firms that can increase aggregate output in the economy, whether it is through expanding an existing capacity, whether it's building a new one. Obviously, what we're also keen on is looking at the new opportunities in areas that South Africa has not been involved in. And so that would be some of the green energy areas, the production of components for green energy, some of the digital technologies and so on. So there's a different set of criteria that that apply. On the matter of whether a company would already have planned it, if you have a weak investment environment, a company may ordinarily invest. But when that environment is very weak, it puts a pause on all investment, or often does so. And so part of our drive to invest in South Africa is to help improve the investment environment. And that gives companies the confidence to publicly say, we will undertake an investment. So I would say a number of the projects that we've announced are new ones. And what we do now more and more, when we do these opportunities to open a factory or open a production line or open a new facility, we indicate how that is linked to the investment conference. Just by way of illustration, a couple of weeks ago, I went to a very big factory opening in KZN that has now about 4,000 workers producing electric harnesses. And we will be reporting in quarter one and quarter two on that. So I don't want to go into too much detail of it now, but there that commitment was made at an investment conference. Similarly, on that same day, I was part of the president officially opening a pulping facility in KwaZulu-Natal that's quite large with a very significant export impact. And it was taking essentially an existing plant and really expanding that plant very, very significantly to be able to do this. And there are many examples. So we are going to, in the reporting for the 6 month period we're working on now, we're going to indicate the connection between what we announce and the investment conference. It's typically done in the speeches at these events, but those speeches don't always, or that part is not always in the public domain. The media may not cover that particular part, so we're going to do more on that. On the question of public and private investment, they are both drivers of growth. So if Transnet actually increases its investment level, it's something that we think we should report on. And what we've seen in the last, in the period from about 2015, 2016 was a sharp decline in public investment, which most economists would say is one of the contributors to slowing economic growth. We had quite a significant boost in infrastructure spending from the period of about 2008, 2007 through to about 2014, 2015. Some of that was around the 2010 World Cup. Some of them were in industrial activities. And so we're now trying to get the public investment level up. All over the world, everybody is looking at levels of public investment. It's in the United States, in China, in the European Union, as an important complement to private investment. So I think, Honorable McPherson, yes, I think it is helpful and valuable that we increase public investment. In fact, part of ESCOM's challenge and storyline is the weakness in maintaining the levels of investment that's required in maintenance of its plants, and that's come back to significantly impact performance of its plants. Very often they break down because we haven't done the necessary investment to upgrade, to improve, to do maintenance and so on. So investment is not only about greenfields, important as it is, it's also these complementary levels of investment that together ensures that we're able to achieve what we need to achieve. Then Honorable Malamecha also raised the question around the SABS board and
It was picked up also by Honorable Tring. So we advertised for, and we looked for persons who can be in on the board of SAVS. When we looked at it, we found that we didn't have enough people who had been in the original list of people proposed by the department with the requisite technical expertise before the end of this financial year, sooner, not right at the end of the financial year. It's our intention to announce the new board of SAVS. It is an important area now that we can see progress being made on the NLC front, which was our major challenge in the past. We can now shift focus to improving governance at SAVS. And of course, the new board would then play quite a key role in helping to appoint a new CEO. So this is an area we're going to move much faster in the period ahead. Honorable Motong raised the question of imports from China, referring to slide 44. Slide 44 is the level of working together with the Chinese authorities to try to address a number of challenges that we've had. We've pointed in that slide to the example of oysters that were not in the list of products that we were able to export to China. And we were able to resolve that one, which assists in getting South African oysters back into the Chinese market and save jobs in the oyster industry. We've raised concerns around illegal imports. We had some collaboration with the Chinese authorities in dealing with a group of companies that imported from China, and they just completely misrepresented the value of the products. And we received information from the Chinese authorities that were used by SARS in court. In fact, I will be asking that particular matter be reported to in the Q1 report, because we got the court case was resolved in June this year, if my memory serves me. So that's an example of where we tried to work with trading partners to resolve some of the challenges. Honorable Mutong raised the issue of industrial parks, which was a point picked up also, Chairperson, by yourself. And essentially, it is one of the challenges we've had with the fact that national government has very limited power on industrial parks. So what we're doing here is we're working on a new spatial development program that is intended to link national government support to the right of national government to help improve governance and ensure that we have the appropriate people appointed to head these parks, and that there is a coordinated drive to get more investment into it. In a number of instances where the deputy ministers, Deputy Minister Majola, Deputy Minister Gina, have visited these parks and they've shared the outcome with me, we can see that many of the parks have just not been maintained well enough that investors would want to use them. I don't want to preempt the outcome of the review that the department is doing, but I have asked the department to look more carefully at an appropriate role for the private sector in industrial parks, because we don't need to have only a publicly owned model or publicly managed model. We can find a way in which we can look at a better partnership to get these parks working better and being more effective. Now, of course, we do need the buy-in of provinces and in some cases local authorities. So it is a process of engaging with them. But at some point, we are going to have to finalize a view on it and then adopt that policy after taking it through cabinet and then make that the new basis. So, Chair, both you and Honorable Motong has raised, I think, a focus on an important area. Honorable Burns Tamashi, on the benefits of localization policy, which is, I think, what the question is directed to us, there's a number of real benefits. We can take any product as an example. If we take a clothing that South Africans buy, when we successfully localize that, it means a bigger portion of that clothing is manufactured in South African firms or in firms located in South Africa. And what that the benefits that we get from it are, first of all, increased number of jobs for South Africans, particularly for young people. The second one is we increase the GDP output of the economy, which helps in a number of ways. One of it is that a growing economy allows the fiscus, the receiver of revenue, as they used to be called, now the South African Revenue Service, to be able to get a higher tax take, which assists then with payments for hospitals and water infrastructure, energy infrastructure, all of the things that the state pays for. That's enhanced when you have greater output. Also, localization helps to provide more economic opportunities for small businesses and for new entrants in the market. And above all, it helps to provide greater resilience in the economy. One of the senior executives of Toyota came to one of the launches of one of the vehicles, and I had the opportunity to meet with him prior to the formal event where we went on the production floor. And he said to me that when South Africa raised the localization issue a couple of years ago, Toyota accepted that that's the new framework and they started to work with it. And they said one of the benefits that they believe they're getting from it is by having a local supply chain in an uncertain world where supply chains are disrupted, it gives them an edge, an advantage. And that was one comment. We've heard more and more of those kind of comments as I've engaged with global businesses who have operations in South Africa. So there are all these benefits. And when we, in our quarterly reports, we report on some of the big industrial initiatives, a factory that opens, a expansion. All of those are the examples of it. And they show real jobs that are created and real industrial output that is secured. Honorable Tring then raised the question of that while investment is welcome, it's not making a sufficient dent on unemployment. I would have a different way of putting it. It's not that the department's policies are failing, Honorable Tring, I would want to respectfully suggest, but the size of the challenge we face requires even more. And it comes, and I want to link that to Honorable McPherson's question, who's Honorable McPherson said, well, if things are functioning so well, should we not be seeing this more in the macro data, the growth rate and job creation, and what is that relationship? Now, I think it's a useful prompt that the questions have given us to be able to talk about the fact that there are a number of different factors that influence the outcome of an economy. A ministry with a mandate to build houses have a relatively smaller number of variables that they need to navigate. And it's a matter of getting the right amount of money, having a proper program to ensure that contractors commit to building X number of houses and then managing it. A modern economy is as all members of the committee know and some would have pointed out in the past, it's a complex thing. It's affected by external things. We may have a program to grow the export of our oranges, and our farmers would be doing a marvelous job. And then suddenly there would be a trade restriction that is imposed by, let's say, the European Union. And that would then dampen growth. Or there would be a war that breaks out in Ukraine and it interrupts our supply of citrus fruit to markets affected by the conflict. Or out of the Ukrainian conflict, the price of fuel goes up across the globe, and that then has a knock-on effect on prices in South Africa. or we have our fertilizer supply chains cut, which then limits or puts up the price of fertilizers that our farmers use. So those would be one set of circumstances that happen offshore. Other set of circumstances that would happen onshore would be energy shortages, challenges with logistics, sometimes decisions by local authorities that limit the impact of an investment or slows it down or delays it. Now, part of what we're building up with Invest SA is the ability to unblock administrative decisions and administrative procedures that hold back the growth and the job numbers. If we had to take the DTIC out of the equation, there would be a significant number of jobs that would be lost in the South African economy, a huge amount of output that would be gone. So what we do is we try in the areas we have the ability to either influence very greatly or where it is completely within our control to make a difference. And then sometimes we benefit from external factors over which we have no control, and they help to boost. They are what you can call your tailwinds. They help to push you further. Sometimes we get obstructed by external factors that we're not able to manage, and that would be your headwinds. They slow down how much you do. You can put your pedal down on the accelerator as much as you do, whatever the equivalent is that an aircraft does. But when those headwinds are heavy, you do get buffeted by them. So I think that what we try to do in these reports is identify projects that we've worked on, where through the collaboration between the private sector and the public sector, we get them over the finish line. We either create new jobs or we are able to save existing jobs and do as many of these where we feel we're getting things right. We try to scale them up. And at the end of the day, while we can't control the external environment, whether it's domestic external environment outside the DTIC or the global external environment, we can make a difference to the overall growth rate and to the overall jobs numbers. And that means doing what we can control and what we can directly influence as efficiently as possible, avoiding corruption in any of that, avoiding maladministration and inefficiency in it, and just lifting the impact much more clearly. And then as the external factors begin to ease up and become better, they can then complement what we're doing, and then the overall outcome is hopefully significantly better than what we can do on our own. But given that there are these external factors, as the DTIC, and I've raised it with the staff repeatedly, we shouldn't rely on those as the excuses. Just keep doing whatever you can do as well as you can do it. And external circumstances will sometimes get more difficult, sometimes they will improve. You can't focus all of your effort on the things that you can't influence. It's the things that you can influence that you need to do as best as you can. And where you drop the ball, as is the case in any human activity, pick it up, try to see if we can resolve it. Sometimes there are trade-offs. You can't get the best of both. Make a decision, go for that decision, and that decision is informed by our overall strategy, and our overall strategy we have set out previously in the committee when we set out the annual performance plan. Moving next to the question Honorable Tring asked about labor-intensive initiatives. So we need to do a combination of these various things, Honorable Tring, and I think it's important to focus also on the labor intensive. In our master plans, we've tried to select a combination of those master plans of sectors that are more capital intensive, like your steel industry, and those that are more labor intensive, like your clothing industry and your furniture industry. We've also tried to say within a sector, like the auto sector, while a lot of our coordination is with the large auto assemblers, our work increasingly is on the downstream component makers and trying to get those component numbers up, because that's where the big job numbers are. For every one job we have in auto assembly, we now have two direct jobs in the production of components that go into those factories. So even where you have a sector like car making, where the top part has a degree of capital intensity, once you get into the component part, you can do more. So obviously within the budget that we have available, we've got to be able to do a lot more. What one of the areas we're able to highlight more and more in future is how we're trying to use resources outside our own budget, because the entire budget of the DTIC is absolutely tiny compared to the scale of the challenge we face. We can complain about it. It's not really the best way to conduct governance to complain. The better way is to say, where can we get money? What can we do that may not require money, but that can help to boost growth and jobs? And we'll give many examples of these in the quarterly reports. And for the new quarterly reports, we hope we can lift the examples out more clearly, that we don't focus on what it is that the department has contributed by the amount of industrial funding, because frankly, that's really a means to an end, that our reporting must focus on the impact, what we've actually achieved through that. And that's what we're going to focus on. Honorable Mwatsi has raised the question of the steel master plan and its support for downstream industries. The reports that we've given in the past have highlighted increasingly the work we do. For example, on trade, we gave the example of wheelbarrows. Now, wheelbarrows is a downstream product. It's not the steel that is produced by the steel makers. It's they would use steel that have been locally produced. The car industry is another example where we see more opportunity to use South African steel in downstream examples. And of course, tool making is quite important. On procurement, our principal support on procurement is to try to get a greater support for making of cars in South Africa using the APDP. And the state procurement, of course, has to comply also with all the prescripts of Treasury. I must say, I drive a locally made vehicle, and I find it to give me very, very good service. One of the vehicles, I think we had, must have been for close to a decade, if my memory serves me properly. And it was locally made car, and it's robust. It's able to give the service, and that's important, that we're also able to show that we don't only do local procurement because it makes sense in terms of jobs and development that we want, but also many South African products are world class, and they produce here, but they are sold all over the world. I gave the example earlier of the anesthetic that we make. It will be used in hospitals right across the world. Honorable Mbuyani has raised the question around trade leads. And on trade leads, what we do is when we have an exhibition, we have private sector companies there, and they then engage with people who come to the exhibition. Sometimes it's retailers, sometimes it's global traders, people who import from different countries in the world. Sometimes it's industrial companies who need components. And those trade leads are generated in the discussion between that company and its customer or its supplier. Sometimes we get trade leads from South African embassies abroad who say that they've been approached, would South Africa be able to provide a particular product in a local market. Sometimes those trade leads come from the work that we do on the visits that the president does to different countries, where we've done a major drive in West Africa. We're about to do one in Saudi Arabia and Kenya. And these ones are about selling South African products in South African firms to global markets. Honorable Mbuyane has also raised the question of the competition concentration report and what steps the Competition Commission is taking. I would identify four steps that the Commission is taking. The first is they're focusing carefully on market inquiries. And so they take each market and when they believe that there is grounds for it, they do a market inquiry. They're busy at the moment on a major market inquiry on online platforms. They're also busy now with an online, with a market inquiry on fresh produce that would be part of, like vegetables and so on, that would be their focus. And that's an important area. The second one is in mergers, they look at whether a merger will increase concentration. And if it does, is there a compelling public interest reason to permit that merger, or should the merger be prohibited? On cartels, which is the third one, they look at cartels. In concentrated markets, it's easier to get collusion going. In highly competitive markets, the value of cartels to those firms is much less. So they look at cartels, and they've had quite a lot of success in what we can call cartel busting. And then finally, they look at abuse of dominance, where large firms are able to take their market power and keep smaller players out, or visit high costs on consumers. And those ones are quite a significant part. We found that the law was inadequate to deal with the issue of market concentration. So we had already gotten a early version of the Competition Commission report in 2017, and that contributed to a major review of competition policy and changes to the law that were introduced in 2019. And now any cases that the Competition Commission is investigating can use these new provisions in the law. Honorable Mbuyane asked about the property sector. It's quite an important sector, but the Competition Commission has got a large number of sectors that are potentially subject to a market inquiry. So they look at a range of criteria to identify a sector, and they take into account the resources that they have available. The new commissioner, building on the really good work of the previous commissioner, is looking at measures to expand capacity in the conduct of market inquiries. And I've had a meeting with the commissioner where she's outlined what is some of her preliminary thinking. She's just taken office recently, and she is quite keen on expanding this work. So that deals with the property sector issue. Honorable McPherson has raised the question on the Auto Green Paper adoption. So we published the Auto Green Paper last year. We did quite careful work in evaluating public comments, and we then did a costing exercise based on the expectation of the industry. The result was a very expensive bill that was not going to be affordable to South Africa in that form that was originally published, and the proposals made by some of the stakeholders in their public comments. So we've had quite a few meetings with the auto industry subsequently to look at different options that can help to make the system affordable, the shift to electric vehicles more affordable. At the moment, we've resolved many of the issues. The key issue now is budget. And that, as honorable members know, is always the most challenging part of new policy. So it's really finalizing the discussions between the DTIC and National Treasury that would enable us to finalize the roadmap on electric vehicles. So while some positive things are already beginning to happen on electric vehicles, the big shift is getting the budget sorted out. In respect of the budget, one area we've looked at is the commitments made by partner countries. We've been working with France and Germany and the UK and the United States. They've put some resource commitment on the table. When we've looked carefully at the terms of it, it's not the most generous offer that has been put. Those discussions are continuing. As recently as I think about 2 weeks ago, we had a meeting of the Interministerial Committee to evaluate some of the progress that has been made in those talks. And because those talks are with counterparties, that we would be seeking to have their money on the table to help us in our transition to a green economy, to a lower carbon emitting economy. And given the challenges that Treasury faces, we've had to take all of this into account in landing the green paper and finalizing it. So the DTIC, narrowly, the work there has been done. It's now a matter of getting the resource envelope in place. On the question of trade agreements and the performance indicators, obviously on AGOA, we're working hard now for the next period. I will be meeting with African trade ministers and with the U.S. Trade minister in December this year, where we will again be talking through the AGOA issues, and then South Africa will then host the AGOA forum next year, where we will have everybody meeting physically. We hope circumstances will enable a physical meeting. And all of that is really about trying to put the social case, the economic case, and let's call it the diplomatic case for the continuation of AGOA. At the end of the day, it requires a decision by another party. And so all we can do is put our best foot forward, our best arguments forward, lift out the benefits that Africa will have and even that the US will have in doing that. But our ability to, as in any contractual negotiation, our ability is on influence rather than on guaranteed outcome. At the end of the day, the American political system is complex. A lot depend on their midterm elections, what is the mood of the new Congress. And those are all matters that we'll try our best to put the best case for South Africa forward, and then hope that a compelling rational case can work. On EPA, it's the same. These are negotiations. No doubt our trading partners would want something from us. We certainly have a list of things we would like from them too. And these are complex negotiations in which it's a careful balancing that both parties seek to do. And we measure our performance in how well our team is able to make its compelling proposition. But all of these are ultimately political decisions that governments make. The U.S. administration will make a decision at some point through the U.S. Congress. So it's not even a decision that a trade minister makes. It's a decision ultimately that the U.S. Congress will make. On the EPA, it's a decision ultimately politically that the 27 European Union countries will make, and they will then debate and work through. So, and within that, there are many and complex trade-offs that we need into it. Each time we meet a minister or a head of state, we put the South African argument very, very strongly. I hope that's covered at least the main questions that have come up, Chairperson. And your remark about strengthening the DTIC's hand in dealing with spatial economic development is a particularly apt one, and we will pay attention to that. Of course, we are talking also to provinces about how to get a better and more effective system in place around these issues. Chair, I don't know if that... if there were any big gaps that you'd like us to cover, but that represents a broad response to the issues that have come up.
And Minister, I've been ticking as you have gone through the responses, and I think we are fairly covered. Can I just put it to the committee to hear whether you are fully covered? If we see no further hands, we can conclude our discussions for today. I see no further hands, Minister, so I think you have covered all the inputs. Thank you very much to the AG, the Office of the AG, that has been in our meeting today for the entire meeting, and also the Minister and his team. We will continue to have a robust relationship in doing oversight over the work of the department, all with the mandate of providing a better life for all South African citizens, as has been repeatedly said by the Office of the AG. Thank you very much to everyone who's been present in the meeting. I now just hand over to the Secretary to indicate to us our business tomorrow when we meet.
Thank you, Chairperson. Tomorrow we'll be meeting on the platform, and we'll be briefed by, we'll have a follow-up briefing from as a result of the oversight that we had in April, where we will get a briefing, an update, a status report on issues that Kmeki raised during the oversight visit. That meeting it will be scheduled for tomorrow. I just received the presentations, and I will distribute it shortly, Chair. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Committee Secretary, and to the committee unit who has been working on the work of the committee. We'll see each other tomorrow. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, colleagues.